This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Welcome to part one of Macro Voices, Eurodollar University, with Alhambra Partners CIO, Jeffrey Snyder. I'm your host, Eric Townsend. There's a slide deck to accompany this podcast, and we highly recommend that you download it before listening, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs that it contains throughout this program. You'll find the download link, along with the other parts of this series, at www.macrovoices.com/edu. This four-part series came about after listeners to the Macro Voices weekly podcast asked for more in-depth coverage of the Eurodollar system. We'd interviewed Jeffrey Snyder from Alhambra Partners several times, and each time, Jeffrey had myriad fascinating observations about the signals that he was seeing in the Eurodollar futures market, which enabled him to both make observations and predictions about what was occurring in the global economy. Our listeners loved Jeff's interviews, but even the finance professionals in our audience told us they needed a primer on the Eurodollar system, its origins, and its history in order to be able to better appreciate and understand Jeffrey's insights about what the Eurodollar market is telling us about today's economy. So we decided to do a full hour-long show just focusing on the history and structure of the Eurodollar system. But before we knew it, that turned into a four-part series. This is the first installment in that series. So without further ado, joining me now is Alhambra Partners CIO, Jeffrey Snyder. Jeff, thanks so much for coming back and doing this Eurodollar University with us. Let's go ahead and look at your slide deck, starting, I guess, with slide three. How does a dollar become a dollar? What's on your mind here?
Well, first of all, thanks, Eric and Patrick, for having me back and giving me the opportunity to explain this. One of the most common questions I get is to go into a deeper, whether explanation or even just a detail of how these things actually work. You know, the things that we're talking about is modern money supply and modern money in general. It's a global system that, quite frankly, nobody seems to have much of a handle on because it's been languishing in orthodox economics for decades now. And really, a lot of it takes place in the shadows, far away from where we can actually directly observe what is going on in the monetary system. So, you know, an opportunity to actually explain some of the intricacies and the arcane nature of the way these things actually work is a tremendous opportunity for me. And I think it'll help a lot of people get a better understanding of how we got to where we are and why we're stuck in this state.
So how does a dollar become a dollar? What is the origin of money, I think, is where you're starting here?
Well, the thing, it's a long journey, and it doesn't start, you know, there's no particular start date, there's no particular end date. It's essentially a qualitative evolution that has taken place over many decades. You know, we talk about the Eurodollar, and the Eurodollar is sort of a loose term here, but the Eurodollar itself started out sometime in the 1950s. We actually have no idea where they came from. It's just by the 1960s, there was this thing called the Eurodollar, and it was an offshore market for dollars. And as technology changed, as the way banking system behaved changed, the monetary system globally evolved with it so that the Eurodollar was sort of at its basis. And it has become so much more than just offshore deposits of dollars. It's become essentially what is more like a computer network where it's just a system of standards and protocols that allow global banks to conduct financial and monetary business with each other. And so that's why I kind of put it a dollar in quotation marks, because it's evolved from what was, you know, a recognizable dollar, you know, a piece of paper that's stamped with the Federal Reserve paraphernalia on it, to what is now a virtual currency that where there's almost no currency at all, certainly no money, because, you know, the gold system has been fully dismantled. But the dollar as it is today, this Eurodollar system, is, for money people, unrecognizable as a dollar. And so that's why it's a quotation mark, put quotation marks around it. And it's a very long history that presents a lot of challenges for analysis and understanding.
And just to put this in context for our listeners, the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, was where the U.S. dollar became the world's reserve currency. And there was an agreement by treaty to essentially settle all international trade in U.S. dollars. That means if people have agreed around the world to settle their trade in U.S. dollars, they've got to have U.S. dollars. So by the 1950s, this market had been established to effectively have U.S. dollars outside the United States. Presumably that began with the purpose of settling international trade, but then the U.S. Treasury became the de facto favored reserve asset for central banks to hold as reserves. Now all of a sudden the whole world has to be able to have U.S. dollars. And so it seems like this market really that you're describing evolving in the 50s kind of came out of necessity, but although the Bretton Woods Conference contemplated this decision that the dollar would be the reserve currency, there was really no plan for how everybody was going to get their dollars, and it just sort of evolved through the banking system. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're right, Eric. And in fact, there was actually a precursor market to euro dollars called bankers' acceptances. And the acceptance, a banker's acceptance is an instrument that goes a long way back. And again, you're right. The purpose of the acceptance market is to mediate financially global trade needs because, you know, a firm in Japan that's doing business with a company in Sweden has to be able to translate one currency into another. And it's not as easy as just, you know, going down to a local store and picking up Swedish kronor so that you can buy something from Sweden. You have to have an ability to mediate between what are essentially very different and often very distinct systems. And so the first iteration of a solution, or at least a more elegant solution to global trade in monetary terms, was something called bankers' acceptances. Now, an acceptance was a fully liquid instrument. There was a market for these things that was provided and made stable by central bank intervention. In fact, one of the first tasks of the Federal Reserve when it was founded in 1913 was to establish an acceptance market for U.S. dollars. And throughout most of the early history of the Fed, we're talking about the 1910s and the 1920s, most of the seasonal variation in the Fed's balance sheet came from buying and selling, you know, increasing or decreasing their holding of bankers' acceptances, all in the name of marrying money supply domestically with the need for money offshore in global trade.
So let me interrupt you there, Jeff, because I want to make sure that we've defined our terminology before we go on. The definition of a euro dollar is basically any U.S. dollar that's on deposit in a bank outside the United States. And the name euro dollar comes from the fact that originally it was primarily in London and other European markets where people were depositing these U.S. dollars. These days, we've got U.S. dollars on deposit in Shanghai, China, or Thailand, or any place else. They're still called euro dollars just by convention, but it means any U.S. dollar, a dollar issued by the United States that is on deposit in a bank outside of the U.S. banking system. Now, Jeff, you just said that bankers' acceptances played a role in the evolution of this euro-dollar system. So referring to slide 6 in your slide deck here, please explain the role that bankers' acceptances played in this euro-dollar system as it began to evolve.
Sure. And the bankers' acceptance market was essentially an interbank market. It wasn't a place where a lot of people, individuals or firms, traded acceptances back and forth. And its role was primarily to mediate between different currency systems and to use the major currencies of the day, or what we would call today reserve currencies, which in the early 1900s was either pound sterling or, as the Federal Reserve increased the dollar acceptance market, U.S. dollars. And so it was a way for global trade to take place such that, you know, smaller systems wouldn't have to hold large deposits of, say, you know, Japan would not have to hold large deposits of Swedish kroner to allow for Japanese firms to trade with Sweden, because obviously the Swedish don't need yen and the Japanese don't have a lot of kroner available. So what they would do is use an acceptance market to either buy yen for sterling or yen for dollars and then use the dollars or sterling to translate them into kroner. It was an interbank method to allow for the trade of goods efficiently, or at least efficiently as possible at the time. And one of the most important parts about that is that these bankers' acceptances were bearer instruments that had deposits attached to them initially. In other words, you had to deposit currency in either dollars or sterling in order to, for a bank to write an acceptance. And a good way to think about it is something like a cashier's check. In other words, you have to present the funds ahead of time in order for an acceptance to come into existence. And from there, it could be traded back and forth. But these acceptances were instruments that were fully reserved up front. And that's an important distinction in how the Eurodollar market evolved from it, because having the deposits required at the front of it was one way of introducing inefficiency in what was attempting to be an efficient solution.
Okay, so in the Bretton Woods Conference, it was agreed that U.S. dollars would be used to settle international trade. Then, of course, it would not be practical if you're buying a whole bunch of stuff from, you know, Sweden is selling things to Japan, to actually send, you know, large suitcases full of dollar bills back and forth on a ship between Sweden and Japan is not a very good way to settle trade. So they come up with a system where essentially the guy in Sweden is saying, let me take some of my owner, use that in order to buy a bunch of U.S. dollars, essentially a cashier's check that's worth 10,000 U.S. dollars. I'm going to give that to my trading partner in Japan, or vice versa, depending on which way the trade is occurring. And that acceptance is essentially the way that we're translating from local currencies into not physical U.S. dollars in a suitcase, but what's essentially a cashier's check that's issued by a bank that is redeemable for U.S. dollars. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, it's a derivative interbank instrument that allows these things to happen, and again, as efficiently as possible, because it's very cumbersome, as you point out, put a suitcase full of cash onto a ship and hope it arrives, you know, or even further back where they would use gold, where gold bullion would have to move between locations and what was usually a dangerous process. And so there was always a search for a solution that allowed these things to happen, to allow global trade to happen, but to do so in a method that wasn't so cumbersome and inelegant.
Okay, so I've got it on the role of bank acceptances. In those days, we didn't have the concept of people in Japan having a U.S. dollar-denominated bank account that they could store U.S. dollars in, but we had bankers' acceptances denominated in U.S. dollars that could be used to facilitate international trade, and each of the trading partners could eventually buy or sell those acceptances on an international market in order to get back to their own native currency. Now, how did we get from there to a market for euro dollars where there's actually dollars on deposit outside of the United States in banks other than U.S. banks?
Well, it's, you know, that again, we get back to the genesis of the euro dollar market, and to this day, we really aren't clear about what exactly happened. Now, one of the stories about the euro dollar's creation was that there was a vibrant sterling trade, because obviously with Bretton Woods, pound sterling was a co-reserve currency with the U.S. dollar. And the Great Britain was dominion over, you know, a huge swath of the global geography. So therefore, you know, a lot of global trade was conducted in sterling. But in the mid-1950s, we went through a couple sterling crises. And then, there was a Suez crisis where it became a little bit more difficult to actually transact in sterling for these types of global trade type arrangements. And so because the dollar was a co-reserve currency, and at that time there was a store of dollars in various places for whatever reason. I mean, some of the stories say that the Soviet Union was placing dollars in banks in Switzerland to avoid any political ramifications, confiscation from U.S. authorities. But for whatever reason, there was a ready supply of U.S. dollars on deposit outside the U.S. so that when the sterling went into crisis in the 1950s, these merchant banks in Britain didn't have to break a stride. They simply switched, for whatever reasons or for however they did it, they simply switched from using sterling acceptances to euro dollars. And what a euro dollar meant was that, unlike an acceptance, they didn't need to be deposits of cash up front for these things to work. In other words, they could just be derivative claims on derivative claim. And so that was an even more elegant solution, more efficient solution to what is, again, a cumbersome problem. So the euro dollars, in effect, started to supplant the banker's acceptance market. Not that the acceptance market ever went away. In fact, it had somewhat of a revival in the 1970s. But by and large, there was this market for dollars outside the U.S. that filled the need for, at first, global trade.
So now what we've done is we've essentially gotten to the point where in the banking system, in the global banking system beyond the United States, the concept of a certificate of deposit, a CD, denominated in U.S. dollars is something that's not only available in the U.S. banking system, but that's also available in the Japanese banking system, in the Swedish banking system, in the Chinese banking system, and so forth. So that if you have essentially the ability to trade certificates of deposit in a bank anywhere in the world that are denominated in dollars, you can trade that CD for a bunch of, you know, Japanese motor parts or whatever it is that you're importing from another country. Is that correct?
That's largely it. It's the ability to mediate trade needs using what is essentially a global standard. That's why we call it a global reserve currency, because it allows these various systems, these very distinct monetary systems and trade systems, to translate one from the other. And that's what the dollar's role was in terms of the global trade network, was to allow these things to happen in a way that was as efficient as possible so that we could, you know, efficient trade means better economic growth.
Okay, Jeff. So we were just looking at slide 7 in the deck, and you're describing how euro dollars are providing this system. But wait a minute, where did the euro dollars come from? How did they come into existence? Please help us understand that.
Yeah, and that's a point of contention that goes back a long way in its history. Milton Friedman, if you go to slide 9, Milton Friedman wrote in, it was republished in 1971. I'm not really sure when he originally wrote the article, but he wrote what was a very good starting point to understanding the euro dollar market and where these euro dollars came from. And essentially, you know, he started out with an example of where he was at a talk of these prominent business leaders and bankers. And this whoever was speaking was asked the question, where do euro dollars come from? And he gave an answer that Friedman basically said was complete nonsense. And I think it highlights the difficulties people have with the concepts of the euro dollar market and these offshore currency markets is that we don't really have any good basis of knowledge for where they come from. We can understand pretty intuitively why they exist. You know, that's what we just discussed with the evolution from acceptances to euro dollars. We know why they exist because there's a need to translate global trade on like terms. But where do the euro dollars actually come from? And that's kind of one of the things officials and monetary authorities throughout the 1960s. You know, if you go back in the FOMC meetings in the decade of the 1960s, in 1960, and the 17 FOMC meetings that took place that year, which produced 941 pages of discussion, the euro dollar wasn't mentioned a single time. The following year, 1961, there was a lot of talk about short-term capital outflows and you know, what became Triffin's paradox or Triffin's dilemma. The euro dollar was mentioned exactly once that entire year. In 1962, for example, the euro dollar was mentioned 15 times. So, you know, the euro dollar started to make an impact in monetary policy so that by December 1968, the FOMC was talking about the euro dollar 28 times in just that one monthly meeting. And by, you know, April 1969, they had mentioned the euro dollar 62 times. There was an evolution taking place in the market as well as an evolution in official understanding of what actually was happening out there in this offshore marketplace for dollars. And there was a great deal of confusion, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, about what was actually going on, because this was, in a lot of ways, a radical transformation of monetary behavior. It was a big bank-centric system that was evolving outside of all of these official definitions and official statistics, and even official understanding. So what Friedman's point was, that there was a great deal of confusion about the euro dollar because largely nobody really knew what was going on.
Well, that begs a question, Jeff, because in those days under the gold standard, stock analysts tend to look for macro cues more than anything else from the U.S. federal government's official data on the money supply. Now, the money supply as it was measured then was the U.S. banking system's money supply. So it sounds like you're saying there was actually this global money supply of U.S. dollars that nobody completely understood at the time, even though it was probably very, very important. Is that right?
That's correct. And you know, part of not understanding what it is means you don't know how many dollars are out there, how many euro dollars are out there. And so it was a source of great consternation, officially and otherwise, about what was going on, especially in these London dollar markets, where interest rate differentials played a big role, as well as factors beyond just global trade, where banks were shifting liabilities all throughout the world in dollar terms. And as Friedman pointed out in his 1971 article, the source of these euro dollars were not actual physical currency, but the bookkeeper's pen. In other words, these were, like I said earlier, these were interbank markets of ledger balances. They were just transactions between banks that didn't actually have suitcases of cash, nor did it have an instrument, a bearer instrument like a banker's acceptance. It was simply bank liabilities traded back and forth. And one of the things that Friedman provided in his article was several examples of ways that we can understand how these euro dollars came into existence and how that market grew, and even the effects of it on the domestic money supply.
So as you've highlighted on slide 9 here, there was an official that supposedly had said where euro dollars came from, balance of payments and dollar reserves of non-U.S. central banks, proceeds of euro dollar bonds. And Friedman was outspoken in saying that that answer was complete nonsense. So obviously that begs the question of what's not nonsense, what's the right answer? And you're getting into that on slide 10. Please explain.
Yeah, and I think Friedman's point was, this was not somebody who was a layman. This was somebody who was, a high official of international financial organization, somebody who ran probably a global bank. And it was global banks operating this market. And here was this official of a global bank who was giving what Friedman called a nonsense answer, essentially highlighting the difficulty with even people within the system understanding where it was these euro dollars actually came from. And his answer that I give on slide 10 is that the source of euro dollars is the bookkeeper's pen, which is, again, an interbank market of traded bank liabilities. And if we start on slide 11, Friedman was kind enough to illustrate several examples of how he believed the euro dollar deposits actually became euro dollar deposits and what the effects of those were on the domestic and global supply of dollars.
Now, hang on a second, Jeff, because the whole supposed benefit of the gold standard, when we still had a gold standard before 1971, when President Nixon took us off of that standard, the whole idea was you can't create dollars out of thin air. There has to be a physical piece of gold backing every single dollar in the system, and that connection to gold is what basically assures that the dollar's value doesn't get inflated away through money printing, what we now call quantitative easing and what central bankers these days think is a good idea. So it seems like you're saying before we even came off the gold standard, we were conjuring U.S. dollars out of thin air through fancy accounting tricks. Is that right?
That's correct. The Bretton Woods system, in my mind, actually defaulted in 1960, not 1971. And one of the reasons for it was this weakness that was contemplated all the way back at the Bretton Woods meeting in 1944. The gold exchange system was created with this inherent weakness in it, where actually central banks could circumvent all of the protocols that were supposed to keep U.S. dollars and pound sterling into a specific value range. And in fact, the history of the euro dollar market in the 1960s is one where central banks were actually and actively using especially swap transactions to do that. In other words, they were undermining the Bretton Woods system themselves through the euro dollar market and the use of euro dollars as a way to accomplish, domestic monetary policy, because central bankers have never wanted to be constrained by gold going back to the early days of the system. So, you're correct, Eric. There was supposed to be a gold backing to the dollar system and the sterling system in particular. But even by the middle 1950s, that was increasingly not the case.
So this is sort of like Bill Clinton saying he never violated the drug laws of the United States. We've got these rules set up that U.S. dollars in the U.S. banking system have to be backed by gold. Let's go get stoned in Europe, basically. Let's go and conjure a bunch of money out of thin air. And as long as we call these deposits euro dollars and keep them outside the U.S. banking system, we can circumvent all of the protections that were designed in Bretton Woods to try to assure the gold convertibility and the true value of the dollar. Is it really that extreme, or am I exaggerating to say that?
I think it in one sense it's that extreme, but there's also this other sense where confusion reigned. You know, so nobody had an idea exactly how it worked. They also had no idea how big it was. So I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why they fell into Triffin's paradox was the idea that there was something going on outside the U.S. and we don't really know what it is. Therefore, we're going to kind of be concerned about it, but we don't know if it's a violation of, you know, the Bretton Woods standard or not, because we don't really know what it is. And it took a long time for people to start to come to terms with actually what was happening. And that was one of the reasons why Friedman was asked to write this article, was because, again, there was so much confusion about this Eurodollar system that by 1969, at least, had become enormous. I mean, in today's dollars, $30 billion sounds like nothing. But that's just $30 billion in 1969 dollars that they knew of. And so they had a sense even then that there was something big going on outside the U.S., this offshore dollar market, even if they weren't really sure what it was. And Friedman's contention was, as you alluded to, Eric, that these were dollars that were conjured out of thin air. In fact, it was a money multiplier system in parallel to the domestic system.
I want to walk through the math on slide 11 and understand what's going on. But before we go there, since you mentioned Triffin's paradox, Robert Triffin was a very prominent economist in this same time frame in the 1960s. And he wrote about this paradox that had to do with the U.S. and its role as the issuer of the world's reserve currency. Please explain for our listeners who may not be familiar a summary of Triffin's paradox and what that means before we move on to the going through the details of slide 11 here.
Well, what Robert Triffin was talking about was essentially the, and he called it a paradox because it's two competing tensions that were created by the Bretton Woods system. In other words, the Federal Reserve and U.S. monetary authorities had to be responsible so that it would maintain the gold exchange standard. Yet, but because the dollar was the global reserve currency, any rise in global trade had to be met by a rise in money supply of dollars in these offshore markets. And so there was a natural tension between supplying dollars for rising global trade and the ability of the United States to back those dollars by its gold reserves. And so he called it a paradox because the two were set in opposition to each other.
So essentially, the U.S. dollar was chosen as the world's reserve currency because the U.S. was the strongest credit in the world. And what does having reserve currency status do for the United States? Basically gives it a free license to borrow and spend beyond belief without suffering the consequences that a nation that's not the reserve currency issuer would normally face, and hence the paradox. I want to come back now, though, to the math on slide 11, and let's just walk through this. What was going on all the way back in the 1960s when the world is supposedly on a gold standard, where a dollar is supposed to be guaranteed to be redeemable for a certain amount of gold? And you're basically showing here how European deposits of dollars are being created that are not backed by anything.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm using Milton Friedman's example from 1971. And what he said in his narrative, he imagined an oil sheik from a Middle Eastern country who decided that he could get a better dollar rate on his CD in a London account, what Friedman called Bank H of London. The sheik started out with his $1 million at Morgan Guarantee, and he used Morgan Guarantee as the example because that's where he was giving his speech at the time. So what happened in the dynamics between how that sheik's money transferred from New York City and Morgan Guarantee and Bank H of London? And what Friedman said was that assuming that Bank H also has a dollar deposit account at Morgan Guarantee as well, the $1 million check goes from the sheik's account in New York City to the new sheik's account at Bank H in London. Now, Bank H in London now has $1 million credit in deposits, and it also has, keeping with what was, you know, thought to be prudent liquidity practice of a 10% reserve, it now had $900,000 in free cash that it could put to use someplace else. And so, and what Friedman further hypothesized was that the UK, that the Bank H in the UK would lend it to what he called UK Limited to engage in trade with some US firms about, you know, whatever kind of trade transactions they might engage in. And so what happened on that is UK Limited, which is his corporate example of the firm doing the trade, is given a check drawn from Bank H's Morgan Guarantee account. So the net result in terms of domestic money is zero. So even though $1 million from the Sheikh's account goes outside the U.S. into London, it comes back in the form of this trade in dollars, this $900,000 check and trade in dollars to UK Limited, plus the $100,000 that remains on deposit with Morgan Guarantee as part of their reserve requirement and liquidity reserve. Now, while the net supply of U.S. dollars is not changed, now the world supply of U.S. dollars has increased by 900,000. That is the $1 million of the Sheikh's deposit that goes to Bank H in London, minus the $100,000 reserve that remains at Morgan Guarantee on behalf of Bank H. So in other words, the U.S. money supply doesn't change at all, while the global dollar supply increases by 900,000.
And if we take all of these similar transactions to this in aggregate, the global supply of U.S. dollars increased to the tune of like $30 billion, which was a huge, huge amount of money at the time. And not only does that defeat the intended purpose of the Bretton Woods system, which was to keep the U.S. dollar as essentially being as good as gold, but it does it in a way that probably very, very, very few people at the time, and only a few more today, even were able to understand what was happening. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, we also have to remember one of the chief reasons for this to start taking place as much as it did was that U.S. banks were constrained in what interest rate they could pay out to depositors by Regulation Q. And so there was no such constraint in London or Zurich or Montreal or Tokyo that would all offer dollar deposits at a rate that was much more competitive than what domestic banks could offer. And so for, you know, that's, I think, one of the reasons why Milton Friedman used the oil sheik in his example was that anybody who was a global agent or a global firm that had dollar deposits had no preference for keeping them in either New York City Bank or a London Eurodollar Bank. They only cared about essentially, or for the most part, what interest rates they could obtain. And the best interest rates could be obtained outside the U.S. because of regulations inside of it. Friedman's point was this was a fractional reserve system taking place outside of a fractional reserve system.
So that covers the example on slide 11. What is being described here on slide 12? It looks like you're showing effectively how this can grow as more and more transactions accrue. What is the net result of this in terms of the supply of dollars to the world? And I'm sure that it basically undermines the gold standard. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, and what Friedman suggested here was that we have essentially a money multiplier system in euro dollars that was in parallel to the money multiplier system in domestic dollars. And what he theorized here in his first example, taking it to the second example, was that Bank H in London still lent the money to UK Limited, but instead of making a dollar loan to a U.S. domestic firm, they instead bought some Russian timber. And so the Russian firm had dollars that it deposited at Bank R in London, assuming Bank R also maintained the same 10% reserve requirement or liquidity reserve, that they essentially this process would continue to repeat until it reduced down to the lowest possible number based on that 10% reserve requirement. And if you follow with all of those essentially follow-on transactions, what you get was, again, no change in the calculated money supply of the United States, but outside of the U.S., the total change in dollar supply available to the world is an increase of $9 million. What Friedman's point was essentially was that entire $9 million was all drawn from a single check drawn on Morgan Guarantee. In other words, there was the deposit basis for this Eurodollar system was in many ways unknown to these other counterparty transactions. In other words, as these euro dollars got multiplied further and further away from the original transactions, they were all based on the original transaction, which was the Sheikh moving $1 million to London from Morgan Guarantee. And so again, to your point, Eric, these are dollars conjured out of thin air through a multiplication process.
So these examples that we've seen on slides 11 and 12, Jeff, what you're showing me is that Morgan Guarantee transfers $1 million to Bank H of London, and Bank H of London does all kinds of tricks, and before you know it, there's 9 million more U.S. dollars in the global money supply than there was before, thanks to one guy with just $1 million. I know how bankers think, though. I've got to believe the Morgan Guarantee guys are not going to want Bank H of London to have that business. They probably want to figure out how to keep the business in-house so that they can be the ones to multiply this money and defeat the intended purpose of the Bretton Woods system. It looks to me like slide 13 is where you're going to tell me that's exactly what they do.
And you're absolutely right. That's exactly what they did do. And it was easy enough for these U.S.-based banks to set up subsidiaries in London or Zurich or wherever outside the U.S. in order to capture or to actually to maintain these deposit liabilities, but do so outside of the U.S. domestic system. And what Friedman went through was another example where he hypothesized a New York bank and its London subsidiary, where instead of $1 million check going back and forth, we now have a $10 million CD coming due at Morgan Guarantee, but that the Sheikh doesn't want to renew it because of the better rates in London due to Regulation Q. So what happens in this situation is that Morgan in London acquires the time deposit at its London subsidiary, being credited $10 million only in a bookkeeping transaction with its New York City parent. Now, on a consolidated basis, nothing happens because it's money moving from a New York parent office to its London subsidiary, and then the $10 million being borrowed back from London. So from the point of view or the perspective of both Morgan Guarantee and the U.S. monetary system, nothing changes. However, that $10 million is now out there in London, which provides a better rate for Morgan Guarantee's customer, the oil sheik. But in moving the CD and transferring the liability to its London subsidiary, the New York City head office now books, instead of a deposit account, a borrowed account. In other words, they're borrowing $10 million from their London subsidiary that's providing them a Eurodollar financing conduit. Now, they get a couple different benefits from doing so, because back then, reserve requirements were a big deal, and a lending transaction or an interbank loan transaction between the London subsidiary and the parent office was free from reserve requirements. So in Friedman's example, Morgan Guarantee would save about $600,000 in reserve requirements by switching essentially to from a CD to an interbank loan. And so we see the potential for transformation from a depository-based money multiplier system to a short-run or short-term borrowing-based interbank system, where dollars can be moved back and forth between offshore and onshore to both avoid regulatory consequences, but also to do things that they couldn't do under the domestic regulatory constraints. So it was the idea where banks could use the Eurodollar system as a way to enhance all of the things that banks want to do, which is to increase their balance sheets and to cheapen their funding rates and to make it much more efficient for however they want to operate.
And of course, all of this happens, Jeff, without any suitcases full of dollars moving across the ocean. The whole thing happens in accounting tricks on a ledger someplace. Tell us where you're headed with slide 14, where you say that not a single Federal Reserve note moves anywhere. Everything happens in interbank liabilities. What are some of the ramifications and consequences of that?
Yeah, it gets back to what Milton Friedman was saying about that the true source of euro dollars was a bookkeeper's pen. Which means that these are ledger balances that banks use to trade back and forth between each other, that used to be done by either bankers' acceptances or, as you've alluded to constantly, the suitcases of cash or even gold bullion. In other words, we've moved from a system of that's based on deposits toward one that's more of an interbank liability system, where what's all that's traded is a bunch of numbers on a computer screen. Even back in those days, where they did a lot of transactions through telephone wires and things like that, it was essentially a ledger system where we're getting away from actual deposits of dollars to an interbank traded system of whatever liability each counterparty would accept. And so one of the things we have to be aware of is that the word Eurodollar, as I said before, is not a technically precise term. At least the way I use it is not a technically precise term. I use it as a catch-all to describe what is essentially the radical monetary evolution away from the traditional format that was based on deposits of dollars toward the more indescribable and ill-defined interbank market of these bookkeepers' pen ledger balances moving back and forth. And so The wholesale part of it is just as important as the offshore part of it. I think we want to describe a little more detail what we mean by wholesale finance.
And I see that the next several slides in your deck dive into the details of the wholesale aspect of the Eurodollar system. But since that's a change of topic, I think this is an excellent place to wrap up this first interview in our four-part series. We'll dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system in part two. But before we close this first part of the series, I'd like to review the key points that I took away from this part of our conversation. The story begins in 1944, when the U.S. dollar was chosen to serve as the world's reserve currency at the Bretton Woods Conference. Because this meant that the dollar would be used for all international trade settlement around the world, all the other nations around the globe needed dollars in order to transact international commerce. By the 1950s, an offshore market for U.S. dollars had been developed in the form of bankers' acceptances. Effectively, a banker's acceptance was like a money order or cashier's check payable in dollars. These dollar-denominated IOUs were the first incarnation of the Eurodollar market. By the 1960s, there was a full-fledged Eurodollar market operating entirely outside of the U.S. banking system and therefore without U.S. regulation. But the Federal Reserve didn't even gain awareness of what was going on in the Eurodollar market until about 1962, when the phrase Eurodollar starts to appear regularly in FOMC minutes. Through the 1960s, the Eurodollar system created new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen, with no backing by gold or by physical cash issued by the U.S. Treasury. All of this happened in the 1960s, when the U.S. was still on the Bretton Woods gold standard system. In a series of articles, Milton Friedman demonstrated how the Eurodollar system had created $30 billion of new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air, without gold or physical cash backing. Because all of this was happening outside the U.S. banking system, it was exempt from regulation that would have otherwise prevented it from occurring inside the U.S. banking system. Not wanting to be left out of the profits that were being made by offshore banks, the major U.S. banks established European subsidiaries so that they too could participate in this opportunity to conjure money out of thin air without gold backing. And the key point to remember is that through all of this, the new money was being created at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen somewhere in Europe. There was never an ounce of gold required to back the $30 billion of new money supply that was created during the 1960s, and it was all exempt from oversight or even awareness of U.S. regulators. In part two of our Eurodollar University series, Jeff and I will dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system. And if you thought the information in this interview was shocking in terms of how little U.S. regulators knew about what was going on at the time, you're going to want to put your seatbelt on for what you're going to learn in part two. Jeff, I want to thank you again. Before we close, though, let's just give our listeners a quick rundown on what you do at Alhambra Investment Partners.
Well, I basically focus on dollars and euro dollars. No, it's Alhambra Investment Partners is an investment advisory firm, a registered IRA. And what we do is try to make sense of the world so that we can invest intelligently and prudently. And unfortunately, in trying to do that in the last 10 years, and even longer before that, has been incredibly difficult because, as I hope your listeners have appreciated through the presentation here, the world doesn't look like it the way it's supposed to look. And so there's a lot more to this story that is very much relevant to 2017. Somebody once said that you can't know the future without studying the past. And I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think, at least I hope, that what we've done here will help people understand that as well.
And we'll have to end part one there in the interest of time. Be sure to tune in for part two in this series, where Jeff and I will dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system in full detail.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and host, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC, and sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information.